You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
Hey, it's all going to work out. Here's sports.
Yes, good afternoon. It's 6 o'clock on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, and that means it's time for Summer Sports Week. Brian Harris here with you till 7 o'clock with 60 sports-packed minutes of sporting news and views. Yes, it's sport all the way. No Chris, I'm afraid he's living it up on the Gold Coast of Australia, but I'm pleased to say we still have Mike with us. Good afternoon, Mike.
Hello.
And we've got a special joined today by a special guest, Richard Boothroyd. He's going to talk to us about a local sporting event close to the hearts of all the people of Cambridge, the Bumps. Hi, Richard. Great to have you on the show.
Hello.
Great to have you. But first, here's the latest news. Rafa Nadal comfortably dispatches fellow Spaniard David Ferrer to clinch a record 8th French Open title at Roland Garros. Nadal beat David Ferrer in straight sets 6-3, 6-2, 6-3 in just 2 hours and 15 minutes and becomes the first player ever to win 8 singles titles at the same Grand Slam event. Cricket, and in the ICC Champions Trophy Group A match in Cardiff, New Zealand beat Sri Lanka in a thrilling encounter by a single wicket. Sangakkara top scored for Sri Lanka with 68 off 87 balls, but 8 of their batsmen failed to make it into double figures and they were bowled out for 138 in just 38 overs. New Zealand in response were nearly undone by the spin wizardry of Lasith Malinga, but they just held on for the win. Tomorrow's game sees Pakistan take on South Africa at Edgbaston. In Formula One and the Canadian Grand Prix is just about to start in Montreal, Red Bull Sebastian Vettel will start on pole ahead of Lewis Hamilton and the Mercedes. The surprise package was novice driver, the Finnish Valtteri Bottas, who started third in the Williams ahead of Nico Rosberg and Mark Webber. And in rugby, Tommy Bowe is a doubt to the remainder of the British and Irish Lions tour after breaking a bone in his hand during yesterday's win over Queensland Reds in Brisbane. Island wing Simon Zeebo has been called up as a replacement. Zeebo joins England prop Alex Corbisiero and Scotland loose head Ryan Grant in receiving a summons to join the squad after injuries to Kian Healy and Geoffin Jenkins. The Lions' next game is against combined Queensland, New South Wales country. In cycling, Britain's Chris Froome has won the Critérium du Dauphiné. Froome battled treacherous conditions to finish second in the final 155-kilometre stage in the French Alps, which was won by Alessandro De Marchi. Froome, who overtook his main Tour de France rival Alberto Contador on the final climb, finished 58 seconds clear of Team Sky teammate Richie Porte, continuing a successful season for the rider after victories at the Tour of Oman, Critérium International and Tour de Romandie. And Froome is now regarded as one of the favourites for this year's tour after finishing second in the tour last year. In football, after England were knocked out of the Under-21 Championships in Israel by Norway yesterday, coach Stuart Pearce had some harsh words for the team. I don't think the players have done themselves credit, to be honest with you, individually and collectively. You get what you deserve in football. Former England manager Graham Taylor believes the money in the Premier League is hampering the national team's chances of success, with top clubs looking to sign foreign stars ahead of domestic players. Only 30% of players in the top flight are eligible for England, compared to more than 50% in Germany. Phil Neville has officially announced his retire from football after an 18-year career and 505 top-level appearances. The Everton and former Manchester United defender said he's hoping to coach and follow his brother Gary into TV punditry. Good luck with that, Phil. Insightful commentary on sport is not as easy as we make it look. And that's the sports news.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
Yes, so welcome along to Summer Sports Week. That was all the news. We've got a busy show for you today. We're going to be looking at, to start with, the French Open. That's just concluded with the magnificent victory by, of course, it was Spain versus Spain in that final. But as you've just heard, Rafa Nadal got a record 8th win. So we'll be talking a bit more about that. Mike has been busy scribbling away with his special sporting reminisce package. How's that going, Mike?
It's almost finished.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, so Mike's going to be looking back at a famous sporting event throughout history. And you've got a couple of clues, two or three clues. So I don't know what it is. And Richard, I'm not sure you have any idea, do you?
No, absolutely
not. Okay, so we're all in the dark here. Mike, what's your first clue? That'd be a good one.
So clue number one. The sport sounds like the short-lived slang for solve it, which is named after one of the biologists who discovered the structure of DNA.
Whoa, hang on. It sounds like the slang for solve it.
Yep.
Right, I don't know what that is. And it was It rhymes with the name of the guy who discovered DNA?
Yeah, so it's named after the guy that discovered
DNA. Okay, that's Crick or Watson. Okay. Well, that's, yeah. Okay, interesting clue. Any ideas, Richard?
Nope.
Right, so anyway, about 20 past 8, hopefully, we'll be talking to Richard about the bumps. He's come with a whole wealth of knowledge about all things to do with the bumps in Cambridge. Obviously, this is a big local sporting event that takes place throughout the summer, and it'd be great to ask him a few questions so we learn more about the bumps, you know, what it's all about, where it came from, where you can go and watch everything if you want to take part. So he's going to be sharing all of his knowledge with us.
I think he's also the first guest to bring in props as well, so I'm quite excited.
This is radio.
Props, yeah.
Have you? Do you want to show us your first prop? He is showing. Oh, he has brought
There's
a prop.
Yeah, I'll tell you
okay.
about that later.
It's a dried leaf of some kind. I have no idea what that is. Okay, so introducing our first big story of the week. Obviously, the French Open has just finished about a couple of hours ago. I thought I'd play a song just to commemorate that event. See if you can work out what the link is between this song and the French Open. I'll give you a clue, it's a very, very tenuous link. Faces all round.
I've got nothing. No. I've got nothing.
This is terrible, honestly. I'm really embarrassed by how awful this is as a link.
The only thing I can think of is bittersweet Seville oranges. Seville oranges coming
because
from Spain.
Because of two Spanish players.
True. Yeah.
It's not bad. Any thoughts, Richard?
I'll
give you a clue. What's the start of the song all about? What's the sound of the start of the song?
Nope.
Okay. Well, what you were hearing there were a lot of strings in the opening section of Bittersweet Symphony from the Verb. And I thought, tennis, strings.
Right.
What song has a lot of strings in? Well, that was the first that came to mind.
That was the first thing that came to mind.
It was the only thing that came to mind. Yeah. Let's face it, Chris does these things better. We should talk about, by the way, if you're wondering where Chris Durden is, he's the normal host of this show. He has gone to Australia. He's on the Gold Coast, the east coast of Australia. Don't know what he's doing, but I like to think that he's gone off to research a special piece on surfing, and he's going to come back in about 2 weeks' time. We're not here next week, but he is back in 2 weeks' time, and he's going to give us an in-depth analysis of the glamorous world of pro surfing.
Well, let's not just hope for it, let's demand it.
We should do, actually. Chris, if you're listening, and I'm sure you are, it may only be 3 a.m. in the morning, whatever it is in Australia, but I'm sure he'll be up and listening to 105. Your mission is to get down there on the beach, on Surfers Paradise Beach, get in with some of the roughneck surfer gangs and infiltrate their world, learn how to surf. You've got about 2 weeks to do it. Come back and give us some tips on surfing. Okay? Good. Right, so there you go. That's Chris Toll.
So tennis.
Tennis, sorry. We should move on. The French Open. So an amazing achievement. And we should, first of all, congratulate Rafa Nadal. He's the only man in history, I think the only player, actually, to be honest, to win 8 titles at the same Grand Slam event. That is amazing.
It's a bit of an achievement, isn't it?
Yeah.
I haven't really been following the French Open tennis, to be honest, and the last I heard about Rafa Nadal was that he was struggling with injury. He doesn't play that often, he doesn't train that often, but you know, when he does play, he seems to still have it.
Well, that was the amazing thing about Nadal. He was out with injury for quite a long time, and I think he had, what was that, a 7-month layoff or something. Came back and it just didn't seem to affect him, actually. His record is quite remarkable. I mean, obviously he's best on clay. And I wasn't sure why. It's one of those things that everyone says, doesn't it? Rafa Nadal, the king of clay. Why doesn't he win more events on other surfaces like grass or hard court or gravel or you know, rubber? What do they have down at that gym that you go to?
It's
kind of fake grass.
It's been
a
very long time since I've been on a tennis court.
So it's interesting, why doesn't Nadal, why is he so good on clay and not so great on other surfaces? Apparently it's because of the bounce he can achieve. He's got an exaggerated forehand topspin, and that clay courts are the slowest courts in the world, which favours his speed, which is ironic, but apparently what that means is that it just makes his normally in tennis, you know, if your opponent hits a winner, you don't really have time to retrieve it, but on clay you just get that extra bit of time. The ball bounces a bit higher, it loses speed on impact, and that gives somebody like Nadal the ability to return almost anything. And basically his opponent's winners, in inverted commas, are in fact nothing other than rallies, sort of ground strokes to him. And of course he can slide, have you seen him sliding around?
I saw a super slow-mo version of him sliding around during today's final. It was a thing of beauty.
Yeah, or what, him sliding along the clay?
Yeah.
He does do that a lot. I wonder if he has to or if he just does it for the cameras. It's a bit like one of those keepers where it makes a great save for the cameras, isn't it? But well done, Rafa Nadal. To be honest, I watched the final and it wasn't really much of a game. I think it was pretty much one-sided. 6-3, 6-2, 6-3. Ferrer, you know, I guess going into that game, no one would have given him much of a chance, and they would have been right, because Nadal just really he made it look quite easy.
There was a point, I think, during the last set where it started raining, and they didn't take the players off, but they made them sit down. And the umpire then called for the start of the game again, and Ferrer just didn't take his jacket off. I think he was kind of tempted just to stop the game right there and then.
Well, I don't know if you were listening last week, Mike, when you were in the studio, but we were talking about the very famous 2001 Wimbledon. You may remember this one even, Richard, but the famous rain delay, which meant that Tim Henman was busy, doing quite well in his semi-final against Goran Ivanišević, and then the rains delayed the game twice. And that really threw Tim off his game. He probably would have won. All the experts and John Lloyd said that Henman was probably going to win. But then after the second delay, they came back on the Saturday and the Sunday. They reckoned that his chance went. And so today, even though it probably wasn't as close, I did notice that Ferrer very much was looking to the umpire with his jacket zipped up, hoping desperately that they would call it off for rain. And they just didn't. And also at that point, Nadal was kind of very deliberately sort of running up and down the baseline, sort of going, "Come on, come on!"
I think at one moment he could have played himself. To be honest, he had that much energy left. He could have run around the other side of the court.
He's a very amazingly energetic character, isn't he? They also talk about his knees, though. That you know, he's got a lot of wear and tear on his knees, and didn't seem to affect him.
No,
he's amazing. So eight. He's also won one Australian title, one US Open, and two Wimbledons. So he's not just a clay court specialist, but obviously he's won eight French Open, so he's much better on clay. Did you see there's a great event? Well, two great events today. You may not have spotted this. The trophy was presented by Usain Bolt.
Obviously.
Who else? No one says tennis.
He's my first pick for trophy giver outer.
I don't quite know why. Presumably he was just in town, or, you know, he was invited along, maybe for a hefty appearance fee. You know, I don't know. Maybe he's a big tennis fan. But anyway, he was beaten in midweek by Justin Gatlin in a Diamond League event in Rome in the 100 metres, so that was another news story from the week.
Well, he was saving his energy for the trophy presentation.
Yeah, for the very onerous job of lifting the trophy and giving it to Rafa Nadal. Yeah. And the funny thing was, though, that he was standing next to Rafa Nadal and David Ferrer, and they both gave speeches in their native tongue, which of course is Spanish. And so Usain Bolt was just staring politely for about 20 minutes as first Ferrer and then Nadal gave this very long, eloquent speech in Spanish. The French crowd were basically silent because they had no clue what he was saying. And the BBC commentary team sheepishly admitted, who's the guy that does it? John Inverdale, is it? He sort
Could
of
be.
Admitted that there was nobody in the studio who speaks Spanish. So they let it play out for whoever, you know, the Spanish people in the BBC audience, but there you go. And also what happened during this game, did you see this? A spectator ran on court and lit a flare.
I did see that on the news,
protesting against the...
Was it Trent Oldfield?
Against the same-sex marriages in France.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I honestly thought he just literally ran on, lit a flare for the sheer hell of it.
No.
Right. So he was protesting against same-sex marriages. Why at the tennis? What's the? Because it's two men playing tennis. Is that it?
I don't really know.
Okay.
I don't really know.
But I mean, it was. I noticed the French security were very much on mission. They were very much primed and ready to go, and they both quickly wrestled. Well, I suppose you would if guy runs on with a flare. You're not going to go, "Hang on, let me just call my boss." What am I supposed to do in this situation? They both tackled him to the ground and, well, dragged him off fairly quickly. And it reminded me of Monica Seles in 93. It was, of course, stabbed by a spectator in Hamburg.
Of course, yeah.
So, you know, it's not like football where, you know, it's quite a way to get on the pitch and actually tackle a player.
You are right there.
Tennis, you're right there on it. Yeah. So, okay, we should also talk about the ladies' event. Serena Williams... 11 years since she last won the French Open. And after last year, she went out in the first round last year to Virginie Razzano. It was a bit of a shock defeat. And since then, amazingly, she's played 77 matches. She's won 74 of them. And she's also won Wimbledon, the US Open. She won two golds at the Olympics and now the French Open. And that's her 16th Grand Slam championship.
I mean, that's an okay record, isn't it?
It's pretty good. There's a lot of talk now about whether she can go on to equal Steffi Graf. Has got six more. So Steffi Graf, probably the greatest player of the era I remember. And do you know who the single most successful ladies tennis player is of all time?
No.
The very appropriately titled Margaret Court.
Nice.
Who's got, 30, presumably, then, if I'm just doing the maths. Oh, no, hang on, sorry, 24. My maths is terrible. But there was a great moment there. So she beat Maria Sharapova. I watched that game, and it was 4-4 in the second set. And Sharapova is an amazingly tough player. And that was quite a tight game, but when it mattered, Serena Williams, she's just so strong and powerful. I don't know if you heard, but a lot of Maria Sharapova's post-match interview, she wasn't that gracious in defeat. Normally they say, oh, you know, Serena played a great match. What she said was, she's just so strong, basically. And she serves, I think she said something like, she serves as strongly as Ferrer or something. She sort of compared her to a man and then realised that she might have gone too far and sort of very quickly shut up.
That must have also been quite a loud match.
Yeah, oh, it was incredibly loud. It was definitely one to watch on mute. I tried to describe
with all the screaming every time a ball is hit.
Yeah, I mean, I could try and do an impression of it on air, but it would basically probably wouldn't be very appropriate. But it was a lot of
shatter some windows.
Yeah, also people would wonder what they've tuned into. There was a lot of shouting and grunting. It's kind of odd because it's accepted now. There must be a point where someone did it first of all, and at that point, if they'd said that's against the rules or we're not going to allow this, that would have been much better.
But wasn't it? You know, Shellis who you know kind of popularised it.
Yeah, she might have been the first actually to make it a big thing, because I remember watching Chris Evert, very late, very elegant. I mean, this shows my age. Very ladylike, sort of elegant sort of player.
In long skirts and wooden rackets.
Yeah, well, you joke, but it wasn't that far off. When I first started watching tennis, it was the likes of Jimmy Connors and Nastasic, you know, some great players. But anyway, there was another great moment again. At least to her credit, Serena Williams came out after her victory on Philippe Chatrier, and she did attempt to use some French. Unfortunately, it didn't go particularly well. She said, je suis incroyable, which I think she meant was, I can't believe it, but actually literally translates as, I'm incredible.
Well, you know, that is also probably true.
Yeah, well, it is. It's kind of ironically very, very apt for her amazing victory. And in that game, this is the other incredible stat. She hit 10 aces in total, which isn't itself that interesting, but three of them were timed at 190 miles an hour, which is faster than probably most of the men serve, I would reckon. It's certainly faster than I can serve.
Yep, I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
So what happened in the rest of the tournament? Because I looked at the results for the women's tournament as a whole,
yeah,
and there didn't seem to be that many upsets. It seemed to be a fairly, you know, standard, yeah, you know, better seed beats less good seed.
Well, to be honest, Serena Williams was very much the favourite going into it, and having seen her win, I can see why. It was an amazing sort of, she's so dominant, and she's probably now the favourite to win the next however many Grand Slams. So it was always a question of, you know, if she'd lost, it would have been a massive upset. And she played, it was 1-2 in the world. Sharapova's probably the next strongest player. The two of them met in the final. And, you know, you're right, it wasn't, in that respect, there wasn't a lot of interest. I guess from the, you know, the French point of view, they'd be looking for some of their local players. I can't think of any French ladies. There must be some.
No. Okay. The only one that springs to mind is someone beginning with M. So that's not really springing to mind.
Yeah, you get all the facts here on Summer Sports Week. Another interesting fact, though, about Serena Williams you may not know is that she has become the oldest woman to win at Roland Garros. So she's 31 years and 256 days old.
Ancient.
So actually, that is old for a tennis player, I think. I mean, it's not like, you know, golf. Let's face it, which isn't much of a sport because you can carry on.
What?
Or snooker or whatever. How old are darts players? But 31 years and 256 days, and definitely the best player on the circuit. So basically all they're saying now, it's about numbers. How many Grand Slams can she go on and win? She's definitely the favourite for Wimbledon. She'll be the favourite for, you know, the rest of the
Grand Slams. Not join the men's tour?
She probably could beat a lot of the men, actually, but I'm not sure that would that be appropriate to have Serena versus sort of like taking on six guys.
Well,
I'm pretty sure you and me and Richard could all be on the other side of a tennis court against Serena Williams and we wouldn't stand much of a chance. Yep. Although, to be fair, we would get in each other's way. But, you know, we should ask her. We should set it up. Let's do it. Yeah, let's get Chris to set it up. Guess who won the men's doubles? You might have heard of this pair. They're my favourite named pair of doubles players. Twice the joy.
Don't know.
Brian and Brian.
Oh, Brian and Brian.
The Brian brothers. The Brian brothers, yeah. That's their 14th Grand Slam win. And they've won each of the four Grand Slams, you know, Wimbledon, the US, French and Australian, twice in their career. And it's also their third one in a row.
They're doubles specialists, right?
Yeah, they are. I don't think either of them have really ever done much in the singles. And they beat... there was a French interest in that one because it was Nicolas Mahut in the final with Michael Laudre. And they won 6-4, 4-6, 7-6. Two sets to one, they won that. And in the women's doubles, there is a couple of players whose names I can't pronounce. Ekaterina Makarova and Elena Vesnina. Oh, okay, that's all right. And they beat Sara Errani and Roberta Vinci, the Italian pair.
That was some good pronouncing.
Thanks. Yeah, I do like those foreign names, get stuck into them. But does anyone watch the... That's the problem, isn't it? Because you get the... I don't know if you saw the... I think it was the mixed doubles, but after the women's doubles, the court just empties. You get these sort of hospitality tickets that are presumably worth hundreds of francs, or euros now, anyway. And, you know, as soon as the match is finished, the everyone just goes home. And it's like, there's still another game! But it's like, mixed doubles, does anyone really care?
No.
Well, obviously not. That's a bit of a shame, really. There was... bit of British interest, though. Did you hear about the British success in the French Open this time?
Well, it wasn't Andy Murray, was it? Because he's injured.
No, he had to pull out, yeah. Speaking of Andy Murray, though, the good news is that he reckons he'll be back at Queen's Club next week.
Excellent.
I think it's this coming week. Queen's is the obviously traditional curtain raiser for Wimbledon.
Yep.
And he's been out with a back injury, so he wasn't involved in the French. But what I was going to say was that the British interest was Kyle Edmund, who is 18 years old. He's from Beverley, East Yorkshire. And he teamed up with a Portuguese chap called Frederico Ferreiro Silva, and they won. They actually won the US Open title. This is the juniors. They're playing in the junior boys doubles, and they beat Christian Garin and Nicolas Jarry, the Chilean pair, and they won 6-3, 6-3. So go Britain.
One to watch out for in the future.
Definitely one to watch out for, yeah. So there you go. That's a fairly in-depth review, as much as we know anyway, about the French Open.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
So, yeah, that was the tennis. And now I guess we're going to talk about local sport. We're here in Cambridge. Obviously, we're broadcasting from the top of Gwydir Street. And beautiful weather. I've been down by the river. And I cycle over the Green Dragon Bridge every morning. And I've seen quite a lot of activity. And I'm guessing that's because all these guys and gals are... That was a bit of Jimmy Savile. Let's move over that one. Are all preparing for the bumps. So Richard Boothroyd is here. He's going to tell us all about the bumps. So, first of all, why are they called the bumps exactly?
Why are they called the bumps? Literally because one of the aims of the bumps is to bump the boat in front.
What does that actually mean? Like physically hit the boat?
Yep. Absolutely.
Wow. Does that not cause
that,
you know,
does generally
injury?
Happen. It can mayhem? Be. It can be. It's an exciting set of races, basically.
Who'd have thought it? Rowing a contact sport.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these boats are quite expensive, aren't they? I mean, what's the typical cost of a boat?
I have no idea. Thousands.
I knew I'd ask you. They're expensive, aren't they? I heard like 30 grand or something.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
So presumably
money,
the
yeah.
contact is designed to be minimal?
Yeah. I mean, it depends. What shall I explain all about the bumps from the start? So this week, the university colleges are taking part in the maize bumps races. So the colleges, I think, do two sets of bumps races. They have one in Lent in February, and they have the May bumps in the summer that normally take place in June.
The May bumps take place in June.
Well, hang on,
they do.
Just rewind. The May bumps. Take place in June.
It's a little bit like the May balls,
which take place in June as well.
Yeah.
Right. Is this just tradition?
I'm not sure. I didn't go to Cambridge University, so I'm not quite sure why.
So there's the Lent bumps.
There's the Lent bumps. Yeah, they took place in February.
February. Okay. I'd rather I was a rower, I think I might skip the Lent bumps because it's going to be a bit chilly on the water.
It is chilly rowing over the winter. Yeah, right. I've done that myself this year.
Okay.
For the second time.
Yeah. I hope you've not hit any swans.
No.
Good.
No.
We're just want to get that controversy out of the way.
There is quite a lot of controversy over the swans on the river. Yeah. Although.
Okay, we'll come on to that in a bit, but carry on with your explanation of the bumps.
So the bumps, it's a unique race to Cambridge and Oxford. Colleges also do bumps racing as well.
Do they call it the bumps?
Yeah, they do call it the bumps.
Okay.
I believe.
Okay, well, I went to Oxford.
You said, you've never heard of them at Oxford?
Well, they call it 8th week.
Okay.
But yes. I'm pretty sure
I've heard of that, but it's the same format. Yeah, it's a bumping race, yeah. So,
I'm not sure they would ever dare name anything the same as Cambridge. You know, it'd have to be different somehow.
Yeah. And I think the kind of origins of it came about due to the kind of narrowness of the river that most of the rowing happens on in Oxford and Cambridge.
So does that mean it's very, very difficult to overtake anyway?
When you watch the rowing at the Olympics, obviously everybody's kind of side by side, and I think in a lot of other cities that where rowing happens, kind of the rivers tend to be a bit wider, whereas the Cam... I've not been to the river at Oxford for a long time, so I can't really remember what that's like, but certainly the Cam is a very narrow river.
It's very
river.
Muddy, that's what I know.
Okay, yeah.
Hopefully you don't test out the muddiness of the Cam
well,
in,
to be fair,
in your rowing boat.
I've only ever punted in both Oxford and Cambridge, so
yeah.
I've never rowed, so I don't really know that if the river... I mean, I'm guessing they're sort of similar widths, and that's why they have a similar format.
Yeah. So the bumps races, they take place over 4 nights... And the format is the boats are split into different divisions because you have usually kind of 18 to 20 boats per division.
Wow.
And all of these boats set off at the same time. There's a cannon that counts down.
Literally a cannon?
Literally, a cannon.
This gets
on
better.
The side of the river.
Gets
yeah.
better.
Hang on. Literally a cannon.
I think it just makes a big bang. I don't think it actually fires a shot anymore. Whether it did when it first started, I don't know. But health and safety and all that.
How does a cannon count down?
There's a 4 minute bang,
right?
A 1 minute bang, and then the final bang to everybody to go because of the way that everybody starts off. Because there's 20 boats in a division, they're all about 1.5 to 2 boat lengths apart.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you can imagine 20 boats, they're like 20 meters each, and kind of you spread over quite a long distance.
Is there a
so
pole?
Is there a leading boat
that gets in pole position, like in Formula One?
There is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the aim over the 4 nights is to be head of the river, and that's the boat that finishes at the top of the first division.
Okay. And how good are
these
guys?
They are considered. You have to be pretty good to
right.
be.
Is it kind of, you know, yeah. Cambridge Oxford boat race standard, you know, at the top of the
I think it probably
division?
Is in the colleges, yeah. I've not personally seen the top college crews, but yeah, I mean it's certainly going to be, you know, people who are kind of university race level.
Exciting.
Yeah.
So you rode in the town bumps, let's just
I it. Rode in the town bumps,
okay.
yeah.
Okay. And
yeah.
the difference I'm guessing between the town bumps and the college bumps is that the town bumps are just what pubs and other companies, organisations.
Yeah,
in the
it's
city?
Well, it's.
Or is it anyone?
The biggest clubs are kind of the town run rowing clubs. So there's okay. the Cambridge Rowing Association kind mm-hmm. of oversees all the town clubs, and there's the City of Cambridge Rowing Club is probably one of the biggest.
And,
okay.
and anyone can go along and
anybody can
part.
Go along. Yeah, they've all got websites.
Hang on. They're not full of ex-students who like used to row
no.
for colleges.
No, so
there are.
So this is kind of one of the things that I think when the kind of town clubs kind of start town bumps kind of started up, they kind of made rules about who could and couldn't row in the town bumps. So
oh, okay.
I believe you're not allowed to row in the town bumps if you've rowed. For a college crew in the last year, something like that. I think that's
that makes a lot of sense
so
to me. Yeah,
it does. Yeah. Otherwise, it'd be a bit harsh. And there are you do get lists of exceptions, so people can. So if you think you've got somebody in your crew that might be slightly suspect, you
a
can
ringer.
Kind of flag them up to
get a background
to the CRA
check.
People. Yeah, and yeah, other crews can say, "Hang on a minute, I don't think he should be." He should be rowing, so that's what's kind of taking place now. Is all the all for the town bumps anyway? I guess that'll have already been done for the university. Cruise.
Wow, it sounds quite complicated. It sounds quite
it's
competitive.
It's quite a complicated thing to explain.
Well.
Yeah, it's probably one of the kind of biggest competitive races of the year. Obviously, with it being over 4 days, so. Yeah, I mean, so let's go back to the kind of start of the race. So
okay,
you get, you kind of
it's just so interesting.
Again. Yeah, so the 1 minute gun goes off, and you kind of count down your 1 minute, and then finally the gun goes off. Everybody starts at the same time. The aim is to literally catch up to the crew in front.
And you start off how many lengths are you behind them?
One and a half to, I can't remember exactly, it's like one and a half, 2 boat lengths apart.
So presumably you're both going at roughly the same speed, so well, that is a lot, because you have to catch up a whole boat's worth.
It is a lot, yeah. Water. So obviously it's a standing start, so in fact you only get, so you start off to the side of the river and you only get pushed out to the middle of the river with about 20 seconds to go. So everybody gets pushed out, the gun goes off, you all set off, and the starts, as you can imagine, because it's from a standing start, are absolutely critical.
Yes.
That's where a lot of things can go wrong.
So you train mostly about... Yeah. When you say go wrong, we'll just head off in the wrong direction. Oh, we've gone backwards.
I think that has happened. Yeah,
How bad do you have to be as a crew to actually go backwards? But
yeah.
Okay, so that you get the 4 minute countdown, the 1 minute countdown, and bang, you go. It's all about getting that speed going really quickly.
So the overall course is, it kind of varies depending on what division you're in. So the higher divisions kind of row the courses a little bit further, but all the courses are about 2 kilometers long. So
courses, plural, there are different courses.
Just where the finish is for the various divisions is in different places. So the start is downstream, just in front of the A14 bridge, and you all row upstream, and the finish is near the railway bridge, past the Green Dragon. That's where one of the finishes is. There's a couple of other finishes, but hopefully the plan is not to row that far. Hopefully the plan is to catch the crew in front.
So there's
lots of things can happen.
Right.
So if you catch up to the crew in front, I said there was contact, but generally they obviously you have to be sensible, and before you get at the start of the race, they basically just accept getting your bow ball past the cocks of the boat in front without actually physically hitting, because obviously that can be dangerous. Once you get past the plow,
Who decides whether or not you've actually overlapped?
Because the cocks in the boat in front.
Is that ever controversial?
Absolutely, can be controversial. So
because you're convinced that you've overlapped. We could have hit you if we wanted. We chose not to.
Can they put their hand out and just kind of stop the boat from?
Well, I think if they actually touch it, that probably counts as a bump, I think.
Okay.
So it probably wouldn't do that.
That sounds like it's been done before.
Yeah, maybe.
And I've seen, when I've watched the rowing, I've seen people all put their hands up.
Yeah.
It's not because they all want a drink or something.
Yeah, no, that's when the cocks in front concedes that a bump has taken place.
So that means they've conceded that they've been bumped.
Yeah, they've been bumped. And when that happens, the boat that's bumped and the boat that's been bumped, they have to move to the side of the river to let the crews behind through. So the race for everybody else kind of continues. So obviously that can be a little bit chaotic. It certainly was for us last year. But,
the actual moving to the side is difficult.
Have to get, well, because the river's so narrow, obviously, like we were talking about earlier, and the two crews have to move to the side. Meanwhile, all the other crews behind are potentially trying to hammer on through. So it depends kind of how close all the boats are. So last year we were pretty close together. There were three of us were kind of close together, and the crew in front of us bumped the crew in front of them, and because they couldn't get out of the way in time, we had to literally stop and restart.
If you're chasing a boat in front, and that boat is also chasing a boat, surely if they make their bump first, are they safe?
They are safe from you, but you can carry on.
So if you bump
the crew in front, that's a bump.
Yeah.
If you're behind them, what you can then do is obviously you try and, well, obviously there are people still probably behind you trying to catch you, so you're still trying to run away from them, get away from them.
So you can also be bumped as well.
You can obviously also be, well, yeah, because all 20 boats have started at the same time, so they're all kind of racing down the river.
So only the boat that's been bumped pulls into the side.
No, both of them. Right. Both of them.
Okay.
The bumper and the bumpy.
Move to the side.
Right. So the only way you can get bumped, sorry, I'm trying to figure this out.
If
you've bumped the boat in front,
you
have to go to the side of the river.
And
once you're at the side of the river, your race
is
done.
For that night.
But while you're pulling over, you can get bumped. You can be bumped still.
No. Once you've bumped, then you're safe. Well, you're safe for that night.
Okay.
But the crew behind, what they can potentially do is, if it happens, quite a lot, but obviously it's quite hard to do, is they actually hit the boat that was in three boats in front of them because they're carrying on.
Yeah,
so that is called an overbump, as you were saying.
Yeah.
So, and that's obviously done an even better thing to do than just a bump.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take a quick break, Richard. I'm going to play a song just because there's plenty more. Actually, there's a lot more I want to ask you about the bumps.
Yeah.
But I've been trying to think of a song that is appropriate for the bumps, and this is the only thing I could come up with, so I apologize in advance for this. The bumper baby. See what I did there? That was literally the only song I could think of that had the word
it was good.
Bump in it.
Apart from the bit where you sang the
that was my Grace Jones impression. Yeah, so I apologise for that. And also I apologise for cutting that song off, but it was only there to... to be honest, what happened was I was meant to introduce the feature with that song. I mean, there's very strict rules from Chris. He's written down a lot of instructions. I've basically broken all of them. But anyway, we're back with Richard Booth.
But he's not here, though.
He's not here, that's true, but he's probably listening over in Australia. So we're back with Richard Booth. We're talking about the bumps. We've gone into quite a lot of detail about the rules and how you can be bumped, over bump, pull into the side. And we've brought in a prop. Which, for the benefit of those people not viewing the webcam, which we don't have, is a sort of bit of twig. It's a leaf. It's a dried up.
It's a bit of twig.
It's just a twig.
It's a bit of twig.
Twig with
it's
some leaves on it.
A bit of willow.
Oh, okay.
So
is that important? That it's willow.
Tradition is when you bump the boat in front.
Yeah.
When you pull over to the side, you pull down a piece of willow, and then you can stick that in your t-shirt, in your hair, or whatever. And then all eight people in the boat and the cocks do that, so that when you then progress down the river, everybody knows that you got a bump that evening and can kind of cheer you on. So this was the this is pretty special because this was the first bump that we ever got.
You've kept
last
it.
Year. Yeah, we kept it.
Okay. And when you say let's just
sentimental reason. So I row for the Radigund,
the
pub at the top of King Street.
Okay.
Smallest pub in Cambridge.
Is it a high quality crew? Is it a low quality crew? Is it a good starter crew?
It's we have a mix. We actually have, considering it's the smallest pub in Cambridge, we actually have quite a big kind of rowing club. So last year we had five boats entered. We had three men's boats, two women's boats.
So if all of the people rowing for the Radigund decided to go to the Radigund to celebrate, they probably wouldn't fit.
Which happens on the Friday night after when the town doesn't finish.
Do you know why that particular pub has got such a rich history with rowing? What's the association? Do you know?
I don't know. I think
the landlord or something.
It started, I think, about 13 years ago. They kind of first started. They decided, you know, let's have a go at this rowing thing, because I think they saw the
business.
Saw the other pubs up and down King Street also taking part. So, yeah,
there are other pubs in the
town. There's
the
Express and the Champion of the Thames as well.
See, they sound good.
Yeah,
well, with a name like that.
With a name like that.
Doesn't the Champion of the Thames have the boat on the roof, or you know, on the ceiling?
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, the
that's one they bumped. You've got a bit of willow. They've got a whole boat.
Yeah.
Okay, so who else is in the town bumps? And there's a few pubs. Is there any other? There's some rowing clubs.
Yeah, like so the City of Cambridge Rowing Club, Rob Roy, 99s.
Okay, and these are just historical rowing clubs.
Canterbridge, yeah.
Okay, and they all have a general sort of range of crews from experience.
Yeah, City has by far the largest number of boats. They have like 10 plus, like 15.
So if I wanted to take part in the bumps, the town bumps, what would be a good way for me to do it?
You would...
apart from going to the pub.
Almost, well, that would be one of the ways. It depends kind of how seriously you want to take it, you know, obviously there's the rowing clubs themselves you can kind of go to, and they have probably a bit more of a structure than kind of we have, but then there's also the pub clubs as well. Mm-hmm. They tend to be a bit more kind of relaxed and friendly, and yeah, that's how I started.
So I can turn up, I can declare my interest, and then jump in a boat.
Pretty much.
Don't just jump in a boat, though, Mike.
Pretty much. We'll probably take you out for a few kind of training things first. There's a little boat called the Tub, which is
like a training vessel.
It's quite a training. Yeah, it's got quite a kind of wide base, so that you're not going to capsize, and it's just got room for two and a cox in it. So kind of you kind of go out in that a couple of times, and then.
And what position do you row, Richard? What's your?
So I favour stroke side. Last year I did row stroke for the beer boat in the Radigund. The beer boat. Yeah, we that was the name of our boat last year, because we have a tradition of at the end of our training sessions, you know, sharing a beer.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah. I thought it was named literally after the beer boat. Something you can buy in a pub. Is there a cheese and onion crisps boat?
I don't believe
salted
so.
Salted peanuts boat. No. Okay. Yeah, and so you row stroke side.
Yeah.
Okay, and is that left or right?
It's.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I don't honestly.
It depends which way you're looking at the boat.
Okay. If you're coming towards me, where would you be sat?
I would be. My blade would be on the right hand side.
Okay.
If it's coming towards you.
Yeah, you're right or my right. Never mind. So, where's the best place to go and see the town bumps? Or any bumps, actually.
Any bumps. Working. I think. The town bumps and the college bumps they start at the same place and finish at roughly the same place. So the best place.
But we've missed some of the college bumps already this year, I guess.
Well, you missed the Lent bumps, yeah. Okay. But the college bumps start on Wednesday and finish on Saturday, and I think.
Surely we've missed the May bumps.
First.
Oh no, because they take place in June.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. The college bumps.
They start at 1 p.m. I think is the first race, and the last race is at 7:45.
Right.
So they get on for quite a while.
Yeah, that's so. You can go after work though, presumably.
You could go after work.
Are the later races the better crews, or do they?
Yes. So the top divisions tend to go later for another reason, which we can get onto in a minute. So the best place to go and see it is probably downstream of the Plough. If you're on the towpath that goes up to Bates Bike Lock.
Okay.
So kind of between the Plough and the last corner before the A14 bridge. That's where kind of most of the action happens. Obviously, you can go to the Plough as well. There's
at Fenderton.
At Fenderton, yeah.
That's a good place to watch.
Quite a good place, yeah.
Is it a good place to watch action, or is it just?
It can be, yeah. Okay. It depends. A lot of bumps kind of take place before there, but there's also a good few bumps take place kind of outside the Plough. It's obviously quite a good place to kind of try and time it, because you've kind of got maximum crowds there. So
the crew's deliberately trying.
That sometimes can happen.
Really? You know? So they get spurred on by the cheers of the drinkers at the Plough. Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. So the Plough is a great spot anyway. Yeah. So quite a great place to watch rowing.
Yeah.
Any facts that you've missed that you want to tell us about that we've not asked you? Anything you were hoping we would ask you?
I'm not sure. I think I was going to explain why the top divisions go later on.
Okay.
Basically, because I guess one question you haven't asked me is how you progress from one division to the next.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Why don't you ask me that question?
How do you progress from one division to the next?
Well, Mike, I'll tell you. So
slick. Super
slick. So the boat that's at the top of a particular division, they get to row twice in an evening for their sins. So they row in their own division, and then they get to row in the next division up.
Okay.
And they're called the sandwich boat in the next division up. And if they bump the bottom crew in the next division up, then that's how you move up a division, and then the boat that was at the bottom of that division will move down to the previous division.
So they call the sandwich boat because they're in the middle of a couple of divisions, not because they share a sandwich at the end of each training session.
Yeah, no, I can see how the beer boat would have confused you there. Yeah.
It's like the trade unions; they have a beer and sandwiches boat. So are you training hard? I mean, what's the training regimen like?
We are. Tough? We've,
is it early mornings?
We're slightly behind where we were kind of this time last year. We're kind of just starting to kind of ramp up our particular training, because obviously we've only got like just over a month to go till the town bump. So yeah, I think we're trying to up it to three times a week. So a couple of evenings after work and Saturday morning.
Ramp up the beer consumption training as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and what's the opening date of the Town Bumps again?
So the Town Bumps starts on the Tuesday the 16th of July through to Friday the 19th.
Okay.
And that takes place in the evening. I think the first divisions go off at about 5 o'clock, okay. And the last one is about 8 o'clock. So and again, kind of the same place between the Plough and Bates Pike Lock.
Okay, so Tuesday the 16th of July, that's the start of the Town Bumps. Would you be willing, if we give you a microphone, you could be our roving a reporter. You could actually report from your boat
as
you're rowing.
I could try and, live reporting.
It'd be like listening to the ladies.
It would be
the ladies singles final.
We're sinking.
It would be worse than that.
Okay, well, we wish you all the best of luck, Richard, with the Town Bumps and with your boat. The Radigund, and wish them lots of luck. And I'd just like to say a huge thank you for coming in to tell us and also everyone else in Cambridge all about the Bumps.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
Every second Sunday of the month, tune in to Cambridge 105 for Our Mill Road at 9 p.m. with me, Kerri-Anne Littlechild. I'll be covering the latest news and events from Cambridge's most cosmopolitan street here on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city.
I should say, Richard, stick around because it's all fun here, and you can certainly listen to Mike's second clue for his forthcoming reminisce package when he talks about a great sporting occasion.
I can't wait.
Yeah, so after the first one, which was something about solve it and rhyming slang for something or other. What's your second clue, Mike?
So the second clue is the oldest debutant in this sporting spectacle was James Southerton, who took part for the first time when he was aged 49.
Okay, 49-year-old debutant
in
a sporting spectacle.
Yep.
So it's a single, so an event for one person, not teams.
It's not. It's a team event. He just took part in the event for the first time when he was 49. Okay. Admittedly, he took part for the first time in about 1887.
Ooh, so there's a couple of clues here. One is it's a team event. The other one is it goes back to at least the 19th century.
Have I just let slip an extra clue?
I think so. I'm going to... Is it related to what Richard's been talking about?
It isn't, no.
I'm so bad at this. Yeah. Okay, so we'll move on. It's just after 7:15. And we'll just round up some of the remaining news stories of the week. And obviously the Formula One is underway at the moment. You can probably, it will still be going on when we're off air, I think, but just to give you an update, I think Vettel is in the lead and from Hamilton, so I'm pretty sure that's how it started. So actually that might not be what's happening, that might just be I think that is true. Yeah.
This is why we don't do live sports reporting, isn't it?
No, come on, if in doubt, just say Vettel. This is the Montreal Grand Prix, it's underway at the moment, and I think Vettel and Hamilton seem to be leading the way there, so that's happening. There's some football stories that I caught my attention this week. A couple of new managerial signings that I think are officially happening tomorrow. Do you know to whom I am referring?
Well, Everton have a vacancy at the moment, don't they?
They do, yes. Actually, that wasn't what I was referring to, but that's a good point. I don't think that has been resolved yet, has it?
No.
Or is it officially Martinez? I think it...
I don't know.
Okay, we should look that up. I thought Bob Martinez, as I call him, was actually taking the Everton job for definite. But so actually that's interesting, because the one I was referring to was maybe the Swansea job is up for grabs, and there's been a lot of speculation about who's going to take over at Swansea. Because it's been a bit of a managerial reaction, isn't it?
Who's up for it?
Oh, it'll be the usual gang. I have no idea. I would guess
Alan Kerbishley.
Kerbishley. Chris last week seemed to think Kerbs' name was in the hat. Probably Redknapp. I think it's between Poyet, possibly, from Brighton, and someone else. Whose
Zola.
Name? And Zola, yeah.
I've heard.
Yes. So two of the best managers from the Championship last year. And of course, why would Zola, of course, lost out in the playoffs, didn't he? Zola, Watford. Boss lost to Holloway's Crystal Palace.
That's right.
So that would be probably a good call, because he would get back into some Premier League managerial experience, obviously at Chelsea, wasn't he, a few years back?
Yep.
So is that your tip, Mike? Is that
I'm going to go with Poyet.
Okay, Poyet.
Yep.
Yeah.
And what about Chelsea?
Chelsea. So, well, I think that's again done and dusted, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah. So I think
I've been out the loop.
I think tomorrow the two press conferences that are due to take place, I think, is Jose, the special one, is returning. Mourinho, Maureen is back at the bridge, which again has attracted a lot of interest and speculation. Is that a good move? Never go back. That's usually the motto, isn't it, for managers? They don't really do well in their second spell. So, but Maureen back in the Premier League.
But Mourinho isn't the special really, one. Isn't really wanted anywhere else.
That's true.
So he doesn't really have a choice, I don't think.
Yeah. And the other one is finally, after a lot of talk, I think Pellegrini is due to be unveiled at the Etihad Stadium tomorrow. This is the Malaga boss who is moving to be, get his hands on the massive Saudi coffers at Manchester City. He's already made a couple of signings, hasn't he?
Much loved ex-Malaga boss. So it'd be
much loved by the Malaga fans, is he?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how he comes across to the City fans.
Yeah, well, as a City fan, I'm kind of looking forward to him because I had a few doubts over Roberto Mancini. I thought he did well-ish, but not probably as well as he should have done, given that he's got unlimited funds. And he never really convinced me. If I was a player, I'd be like, I don't get this guy. I don't get him. I'm not sure he's a good man manager. Yeah. Okay, we've got Mike's reminisce package to come up in the last 10 minutes. I thought before that, have we all chosen? I don't, Richard, we should have given you a bit of forewarning, actually. But I think we normally at about this time, we choose a sporting hero of the week. I don't know if you've thought of one. But don't worry if you haven't, because Mike and I have both picked one, and we'll say who that is in just a second. So I'll start with you, Mike. Who have you chosen for your sporting hero this week?
Well, James Anderson.
Jimmy Anderson.
England fast bowler. Probably the best England fast bowler of recent times. He has just overtaken Darren Goff to get the record number of one-day international wickets.
Has he? All-time leading ODI wicket taker for England.
For England, yeah.
Wow.
Well done, Jimmy.
Good work, Jimmy. And that was during our excellent win against Australia in the Champions Trophy.
Yep, that was yesterday, Saturday. Okay. So, a kind of dominant victory as well. So it was good to get some milestones out of the way.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, Australia are the holders of that title, but it does change. It just seems to change every time they run that tournament, that it's got a different name.
Yep.
And it's the last time they're going to run it this time around, is that right?
Who knows? Who
they
knows?
Just seem to dabble with the formula. Oh, I was going to ask you about the cricket in a minute. My sporting hero of the week. Well, I'm tempted by Kyle Edmund because I think we need some cheering up in British tennis, and this guy does seem to be the business. And I remember when we had Andy Murray, and he was doing the business in the juniors, and people were talking him up. So hopefully Kyle Edmund from Yorkshire, East Yorkshire, can be another Andy Murray.
Nothing like crippling young talent with tremendous pressure.
Yeah. Well, obviously, a lot of pressure coming from this station, Cambridge 105, heaping the pressure on young Kyle Edmund. But yeah, it's great. I mean, he seemed to be a quite confident chap, did well in the press conference afterwards and in an interview. So we like him, yeah. Also, I should give a shout out, really, to Serena Williams. Anyone who attempts to speak French to the French, and we've probably all done in restaurants, deserves a pat on the back. So there you go. That was our sporting heroes of the week.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
Okay, you got a final clue, Mike, because I'm in the dark, I have to admit.
Final clue. Yeah. So the year in which this particular event took place also saw Tom Cruise propose to Katie Holmes.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Nicole Kidman.
No.
Okay, I'm guessing
a recent one.
2005.
It is 2005, Brian. Your celebrity knowledge has dug you out of that hole.
Well, I was there. I was invited to the wedding. I was a bit disappointed because I'm pretty sure that she'd accepted my proposal the week before. 2005. It's not golf.
It's not golf.
Is it debutante? Is it snooker?
No, it's not.
Darts.
No.
I'm guessing wildly now. Is it part of an Olympics?
Shall I tell you?
Yeah.
It is the 2005 Ashes series.
Ah.
The sport is cricket, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
As in crick, solve it. Crick it. Cricket. Crick. No.
Was that first clue?
Yep. Yeah.
Crick it.
Yep.
Right. Oh, okay, and what was the other bit of the clue?
That was it. It was named after one of the biologists who discovered the structure of DNA. Crick. He was so successful that he went round the labs just going, cricket.
Okay, well, take us back, paint... Yeah, sorry, let's move on, Mike. Take us back to paint a picture of the scene. Historic victory for somebody or other, wasn't it?
So it was, yeah. The summer of 2005, Australia had come to England, having held the Ashes since 1989, which is 8 successive series wins. And they were absolutely favourites to win another one. Over the previous 16 years, England had actually hit rock bottom, as cricket is concerned, literally ranking bottom of the Wisden rankings. But by 2005, England were back up to second in the world and actually came into the series showing a bit of form. But that didn't stop Glenn McGrath, the Australian fast bowler, from confidently predicting a 5-0 whitewash, which actually looked possible during the first test, as Australia kind of ended up winning it comfortably, but not after some aggressive England bowling, which actually drew blood from Ricky Ponting's face, which was fairly amusing. it was kind of amusing because cricket is a gentleman's sport, but after he was hit in the face, no England cricketer walked up to Ricky Ponting to ask if he was all right.
Ooh, that's bad, isn't it?
As he was, you know, crouched bleeding. Mm. So Australia went 1-0 up. England just edged the second test with a massive 2-run victory. Andrew Flintoff, again, like he did in the first test, contributing with both bat and ball. So that kind of tied it up at 1-1. The third test, England were dominant for the first 4 days and left Australia a target of 399 runs to get on day 5. In the end, England ended up winning, but not after a valiant attempt by the Australian batsmen, including actually Ricky Ponting. But they managed to survive the last 4 overs with Brett Lee and Glenn McGrath, their two worst batsmen. And they ended up only actually 52 runs short of winning the match themselves, which, you know, from the start of the day was an amazing feat. The fourth test, England kind of dominated again, you know, similar story. First innings got a big score of 477. Australia, in their first innings, got 218 and were forced to bat again. The Aussies' second innings was better, but left England only needing 129 for the win. 129 runs, easy, right? Well, no. England, kind of as almost predicted, managed to win the match, but only after losing 7 wickets, actually, trying to limp over the line. And so to the final test, England led the series 2-1, but an Australian victory would still mean that they would retain the Ashes. And after the first innings, it was all fairly even with England leading by 6 runs after 4 days. So if England wanted to win the Ashes, they needed to bat out the final day, and they did it in some style with Kevin Peterson scoring a thrilling 158.
KP doing his stuff.
Even if it did look like he was wearing a badger on his head. That was a terrible, terrible haircut.
Yeah, but who cares, you know? When you've got skills like that. And is he coming back, KP, soon to before the Ashes?
He may take part in some of the Ashes, yeah. Okay. Hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yeah. Is that it?
That is it.
Wow, so the 2005 Ashes, brilliant. And there is cricket going on right now, of course. And, you know, we were talking before about the brilliant game between New Zealand and Sri Lanka. Who's your tip for this tournament, Mike? Who's looking strong?
Well,
England, maybe?
Before, I would say Pakistan, but they lost to the West Indies. Actually, the West Indies are my tip.
Okay, so we heard it here first. Mike says, I think England might stand a bit of a chance, but, you know... we will see. So anyway, thank you, Mike. That was a great journey trip back through, well, some of the mists of time anyway, to a very famous win there by England.
You're listening to Summer Sports Week on Cambridge 105.
So yeah, we've come almost to the end of the show, actually. I guess we should just quickly give you a bit of a trail for some of the sports that you can see coming week. The ICC Champions Trophy continues. Pakistan versus South Africa is tomorrow's game. That's at Edgbaston. So if you've got the day off work, you might want to head down there and pop down and see that one. The Lions Tour carries on. There's plenty more games. The next game for the British and Irish Lions is on Tuesday, the 11th of June, against the combined Queensland New South Wales country. And then there's football, the under-21s, even though England are out, the tournament still carries on, and tonight's games are Holland against Russia, and Germany are playing Spain in the under 21 championships. And we did make a mistake. The Formula One is starting in about a minute's time, so actually you can you can actually go home now, stick the tally on.
Still correct
that.
Though, so Vettel is still in the lead.
Vettel is still technically in the lead. Yeah, that's right. So yeah, we're not actually back next week, because I think Mike's going off to find out about Brazilian surfing, aren't you?
Yeah.
So I'm expecting a full report in 2 weeks' time. But yeah, Chris will be back in 2 weeks, and I think we'll be looking forward to probably Wimbledon will be about to start. He'll be excited about the Tour de France, I know that. And then, of course, we can do a preview of some of the big summer sports like the Ashes. So we'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
We love this city. Cambridge 105.